a better way. You don't have to think.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirico with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. All right, folks, and as I was saying in the housekeeping segment, we do have Brandon Shelton with us today. Brandon's been deeply involved with relief efforts down into Haiti since that earthquake, which, believe it or not, is close to a year ago, and a lot of things have changed, and a lot of things haven't changed since then as we've gone on with our lives, and he's here to talk to us about that and a lot of other things that I think in the prepper community are really going to be helpful to us. So, hey, Brandon, thanks for joining us today on the Survival Podcast.
Yeah, no problem, Jack. Thanks for having me.
Just so folks can kind of get a feel for you and what you're all about and where you're coming from, I know you're a paramedic and you've done a lot with the medical community, but you're also a prepper, kind of in your own life. How did you kind of get into the whole emergency preparedness, disaster preparedness mindset?
I grew up to an extent with my family. We're a southern family, but my family being in preparedness and growing up, it was more. My direct family is more geared towards preparedness. Was the Russians are coming, and all the way through their early childhood. But my dad's always drilled it into that when times get tough, you can't depend on anybody else but your family and yourself to provide. Excuse me. And I guess I really got into it after a couple trips to third world or developing nations, after walking through South Africa and looking at things there, and a couple other nations I've been in, and the Balkans, and just seeing how bad it can get, how quickly it can get that bad. And if you're not ready for it, then you're just gonna end up another statistic. Some of those situations with warfare and real natural disasters, the deck's pretty stacked against you to be a statistic anyway. So anything you can do to improve those odds. And once I became a husband and a father, it just really, now it just wasn't me. And a couple of roommates, it was, I actually have a true responsibility to another human being or several human beings now. So I guess that's what really led me into it over the years. And my wife really got on board sitting watching CNN and, back in 2005. After we moved back to Florida, and she's watching Katrina, and then it kind of made sense, and she got on board, which helped out tremendously. And since we've been listening to you since the beginning, and prior to starting to listen to TSV, it was mainly Red Dawn and MREs and lots of 5.56 rounds. And since then, my wife got on board, and that actually really made our preps rounded out and made them more realistic.
Yeah, I think it does help a lot when both spouses are on board. And I think, honestly, there's a reason that we're set up as a family unit with a male and a female. Women bring some things that round off some of our rougher edges in prepping and in life. But you're saying you've been to all these places. I hadn't really talked to you that much about your background before today. Were you doing all of that as part of relief efforts in the medical world, or do you have prior military service or anything like that? Or what's taking you around the world like that?
I'm prior service, prior Army. I've been to, like most of us that were infantry, I've been to some of the greater armpits of the world. And I've traveled Eastern Europe and some down south in the military, and then my experiences in Africa have been through our old church that we went to in Arizona. I co-led a mission trip to South Africa years ago, and that kind of got me interested in the actual relief field, especially from a medical standpoint of how somebody with just a little bit of training could make a serious difference to people.
Yeah, gotcha. So how'd you get into the medical field? You're 11 bullet catcher in the Army, then you were 11 Bravo, and you come out and you end up as a paramedic. How'd that happen?
My father's a 33-year veteran firefighter and paramedic, and I grew up hearing stories and picking up tips from him. And then with the CLS course, combat life saver course in the service, that perked my interest. And basically what it really come down to is I needed something that'd be a good long-term career, and EMS looked like a good place to go. So I got my EMT basic, then went on to paramedic, and over the years I've advanced my training to critical care paramedic, flight medic.
Very cool. Well, so it takes a certain kind of mindset to say, okay, this is what I do in my life, but then I'm going to take it to other parts of the world, and I'm going to help people when they're in a bad way. So I think I probably speak for everybody here when I say thank you for the fact that you've been willing to do that. And what I want you to do now is kind of take the audience back to, like as we said, almost a year ago, the quakes just happened. You guys decide you're going to get down there and do whatever. You don't even know what you can do yet, and you're going to go. And, you know, how did you put that together, and what was it like when you first got there to Haiti?
The way we got into Haiti was, or Haiti came about, at least for us, was the day of quake. The quake hit January 12th, roughly around 5, about 1700, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I got a call. I think it was late that evening, about 7, 8 o'clock that evening, from a pastor of a church we used to go to, that they had a village that they supported, an orphanage that they supported in Haiti. And he called and said, you know, how many paramedics do you think you can get together that can make it down in Haiti and get down there and, you know, live out of your rucks and help out in this village? And he was explaining, you know, the security situation, that he understood it and how everything was going. And of course, I was just seeing it on the news. The first initial reports were coming in and the first videos coming out of Haiti. I got several, in this past afternoon, several friends of mine are have contracting experience. And so I said, well, the first question I asked was, well, what's it say? And he said, well, it doesn't say anything. So the list just got real short. But I called a couple of buddies of mine that fit that criteria. And they said, yeah, we'll go. My friend Chris, who's a paramedic out in San Diego, we've run around the world together doing foolish things for a long time. But I called him up and said, hey, you ready for a pretty good adventure? And he said, well, let me swing by the house and grab a change of drawers and socks and my pistol where we meeting. Him and another paramedic guy, another paramedic buddy of mine, John Eric, who's he's a medic here in Jacksonville as well. They were good to go, and so we decided, yeah, we can go. And I called the pastor and said, okay, I got myself and two other men. We need to pick up some supplies and, you know, some, we had to be suspicious. We need to pick up some extra supplies and this, that, and the other. How are we getting there? And you know, how do you want to work out us picking up these supplies that we need in the Well, pastor says, well, we don't exactly have any money to send you. We have no idea how to get you there.
Huh.
And he says, I'll get back with you. And to be honest, from there, it was just a God thing. Logistically, putting together anything to get into Haiti at that time was just a nightmare. There's no commercial air traffic going in. The military had yet to come in, and our military had yet to come in and take control of the airport there in France, and everything that I was hearing. I was talking to people on the ground there that I'd been put in contact with, and it was, you talk to them, and all here in the background was, you know, gunfire, and everybody said the same thing. It's terrible. Get down here as soon as you can. You know, we need help.
Yeah.
And God just kind of just dropped it together for us. I ended up I'm not even exactly sure how I got connected up with a group called Air Mobile Ministries out of Titusville, Florida. And they didn't have big enough aircraft to be able to get over there with, you know, they have very small, you know, single engine aircraft and private aircraft, but they hooked me up to Missionary Flights International out of Fort Pierce. And, just to give a plug for Hendrix Motorsports, a lot of people don't know, but, he donated, two Saab 2000s and I think like $2 or $3 million to keep them flying and,
wow.
for a month, making four round trips a day out of Fort Pierce, Port-au-Prince, doing nothing but bringing in, medical personnel and supplies. But, we bummed a flight with them. And the thing about that was that they said, we'll get you there, but you're on your own for getting home. It was kind of, they fly in medical personnel, fly out patients going back to the States, and, U.S. citizens that were, you know, living in Haiti as missionaries or, working for other NGOs, fly them back out. But, their advice was when you're ready to leave, just kind of show up at the tarmac and start asking people if you can bum a ride. But so we knew we could get in, and we knew eventually we'd get out. And worst comes to worst, it's not that right far of a ride over to the Dominican. It's only 8-9 hours to get into the Dominican Republic and fly out from there, because the Dominican was completely unaffected by the quake.
Sure.
But we got in and got on the ground there in Haiti and collected our gear. And there's no customs, no immigration, nothing like that. They collected everybody's passports, actually people that were working beforehand by, and they said, well, when are you planning on leaving? And you told them when they're planning on leaving, and they just added a couple of dates to your stay, and you got your entry and exit visa at the same time.
Got you.
So we had made contact, or had our contact that was going to come pick us up there at the airport and give us a ride back to the village, which is in Bon Repos, which is about 7 miles outside of the airport in Port-au-Prince. And looking at it from the air, you know, you can see all the destroyed buildings and all you see. I wish I had photographs in the air, because all you see in the streets is just tens of thousands of people just everywhere, just in the streets of Port-au-Prince. And the first thing I noticed, once you got away from the aircraft, and you just took a breath, all you could smell was just death, because this was a quake post, I can't remember, several days after the quake. But that's what the Port-au-Prince is. From what I've understood, prior to the quake, has never been a very fragrant city, but this was just exactly what it smelled like. It just smelled like death. I mean, everywhere you went within the city, if you didn't have a shema or some vapor or something under your nose, then you weren't going to be a whole lot of good to anybody, because you'd just be sick.
So, yeah, I want people to kind of understand what this was really like, because I think that we have a tendency to feel that we're somehow insulated here in America. And what this was really about was a whole lot of people killed really fast, and what infrastructure there was for support dissolving overnight, not being able to be replaced. And at that point, we get into just basically a human condition. And, you know, there's probably good and bad in humanity at that point. Tell us about some of the things that went on down there when you first got there with kind of that respect. People that were trying to do what they could, and then people that were doing anything they could to survive, and people that probably were pretty decent people one day kind of stealing and doing whatever they could just to get by the next.
At the time that we had got there, you know, Haiti had very little infrastructure prior to the event. They had, you know, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, so it was bad. You know, it was bad 5 minutes before the earthquake, and it was exponentially. It was, I mean, just hell on earth after the quake. You know, you're talking about a city. I think I can't remember how many people lived in Port-au-Prince at that time. I think the population of the country, I want to say, it was like 7 million. The quake happened within 24 hours. The estimates are between 230 and 250,000 people died. 65% of all the buildings in Port-au-Prince were either destroyed or too dangerous to enter. There's never been any true municipal water or anything like that, but what water was available on a daily basis was gone. The people that did have wells, that their water was safe for drinking for the native Haitians. Of course, you know, you or I, we couldn't drink it without getting sick, but they could. I don't know if something with the aquifer shifted or what exactly caused it, but all the wells became contaminated with bacterial and viral and chemical contaminants.
It's probably runoff from the, you know, the damage from the quake and how many people are laying around dead. It's probably runoff that caused that. Wow.
Yeah, that it's, you know, when we rolled in, we're rolling through the city as we got there. You know, you approach the gates and then you had the airport secured, and that's the only thing that was keeping all the Haitians, because they could see aid coming in. And the big problem with all that aid coming in, there's just nobody there coordinating getting out. The corruption of the Haitian government is beyond description. Anybody that's been involved in any developing nation understands the corruption, but anybody that's been in Haiti can tell you it's on. They could get to another level. You'd have the first few flights that were coming in, you'd have a quote customs official get on and say, oh, there's a $1,500 takeoff and landing fee, $750 to land, $750 to take off. It's due payable now in U.S. dollars and in cash. And if you don't want to pay it, you can't get off the aircraft and you refuel and you can't take off. And that was what it was like before our military got in there and took over the airfield and put a cap to it. But this is an example. I mean, it started immediately. But as far as, you know, we rolled into the city and bodies, everywhere you look, bodies, men, women, children, babies, stacked like cordwood. And there's nobody coming to pick them up, so they're just sitting there in the tropical sun. You pass a drive over canals and look down into the canal. And I know in one picture we have, you can see people bathing and getting water and everything out of one of these rivers, out of one of these canals. And you turn around and we shot upstream, and there's probably 15, 20 bodies at a little bend in the stream, kind of log jammed in there.
Mm.
And it's but you're trying to, you know, you knew we'd be overwhelmed with what to do and where to go and where to help right when we got there. Because everywhere you look, there's people that within in the States, you know, you would immediately, you know, they would have already been picked up and treated, you know, by the 911 system. But everywhere you look, there's just people with you know, head injuries and fractures and, you know, open fractures. First person we actually stopped to help is a small girl, about probably 6 years old, just sitting on the side of the road with her mother, and she's got an open tib-fib fracture. You know, so basically, about mid-shin, her leg is twisted 90 degrees the wrong way, with exposed bone, and I mean, that's a horrific injury, and this has been like that way for days, you know, with no treatment. Yeah, and we stop, you know, and you get out and put our bag down, and that's what we learned kind of at that time. The rule of thumb was if you set something down, they just assumed you didn't want that. But set one of our jump bags down, and next thing you know, there goes our nice blaze orange jump bag disappearing down the street. And one of my men threw his weapon up, you know, and sighted on the guy, and he says, you know, what am I going to shoot the guy in the back for nothing, you know, for a bag that we have another one of? And so we wrote the bag off and started packaging the kid to try to transport him to, we had heard that the field hospital, Miami Field Hospital, University of Miami had set up a field hospital or was in the process of setting it up. And then you kind of hear a commotion coming through the crowd, a large group of people. So we started getting nervous, thinking somebody's got into the bag, found out there's some stuff in there that they could use. Now they're coming back for more. So we're basically, we know we can't get out because of the traffic and just the mass of people, so we're just going to set up a defensive perimeter and get ready to hold what we got. And here comes this group through the crowd, probably, I don't know, 20-plus people, men, from kids up to the guy that was leading the pack, had to have been in his 60s or 70s, and he's got my jump bag, and they're dragging the guy that took it, and they beat the fire out of this guy. I mean, beat him bad, and he gives the bag back to us, and, you know, so sorry. You know, and turns and kicks the guy in the face and spits on him, you know, and he is a catch-all word for, you know, thief, scumbag, gangster, you know, and calls him that Creole word and spits on it again and so sorry. So he's thank you for you come to help. So it was, you know, even in the midst of these people are literally, you know, there's people getting killed over bottles of water or bags of water, and you still have, you know, the good people of the city that are banding together and trying to stop the criminal element. You know, the prison in Port-au-Prince is also destroyed, and you have 2,000 Haitian convicts that went running loose on the streets.
Mm.
It ain't quite like here. You know, you got to really screw up to go to prison in Haiti. You have your real bad, at least in the Port-au-Prince prison, which wasn't a political type prison. It was a criminal's prison.
It's interesting that they even have that distinction, you know. I think that we in America we look at our government and we think of how bad some of the things are, but we also tend to not realize how good we have it. We don't have a political prison in the United States, at least not yet. So these guys have a place for criminals and then, you know, people that have crossed the political line.
Right.
And kind of being down there and seeing all this, and you know, the stuff we talk about as far as preparedness every day. What are maybe some lessons you came away with? Like, you were telling me that, like, if you would have had a whole bunch of food stored in Port-au-Prince, it didn't do you any good because it was under rubble. The only choice these people would have had had been to have someplace to go.
Yeah, and that's what I really took away. But one of the biggest things, you looked at it, it didn't matter if you were living in Port-au-Prince, it didn't matter how well you were prepared. Short of, you know, your house having been not destroyed, which, of course, there's no building code or anything over there, and that had a lot to do with this the destruction of the buildings. But either way, you know, you could have been sitting on, you know, a year's supply of food for your family and, you know, 500,000 rounds of ammo and all the medical supplies and everything you needed, you know, for you know, a long-term event. It's buried under, you know, 30 metric tons of rubble of concrete block. It's not going to do you any good, and there's no way you're getting to it. And even if you could get to it, you wouldn't survive that, you know, you got 2 million people that are now homeless and hungry and thirsty, and you got something, you're not holding off that many people, you know, no matter how much we all want to think that, you know, we could ruck up and go to guns and hold our own. It's just no way.
Yeah. Sure.
So if you didn't have someplace outside of someplace to go that was prepared outside of the event zone, then outside of the, basically outside of Port-au-Prince and further out than that, if you didn't have someplace to go that was hours away, then you were just in a bad shape as everybody else in the city, no matter how you were prepared locally. And that made a big impact on me and changed the way I do some things here at home.
So us survivalists that have gone as far as to set up a bug out location, we're not as crazy as people think we are we?
Exactly. And that's, I guarantee if you were to take anybody, that would have looked at it from the point of view of, yeah, if you got a bug out location and, you know, you're into preparedness or you're a weirdo anyway, and you've gone as far as to have a stock bug out location and then you show them the city and what it was looked like and what it was like there after the quake, I don't see how you can not see the wisdom of light and the idea of having a separate location to fall back to. Because like I said, it didn't matter. Even if you kept all your preps and your structure would have survived, you wouldn't have survived the first night. You know, or the first
sure.
night, the first hungry night, I should say. And that was the other thing. After the sun went down, it was a different world. It was scary during the day. But after the sundown, that's all you heard was just gunfire. We have a couple of videos we shot. We slept on a roof in the village of a small single story building. Everybody in Haiti lives in, or at least in Port-au-Prince, they live in a compound. You know, you have 10-foot, you know, glass bottle top walls and large, you know, big steel gates. Well, all those for the most part were down. At least the village, they were all down. We tried to secure it as best we could, and obviously nobody wanted to sleep inside after the quake. So we set up on a rooftop because we checked on the building and didn't like what we saw with the structural integrity of the building. So we decided to sleep on the roof because everything's block construction. You have a solid, you know, basically the only thing with any real amount of rebar in it is the rooftop.
Mm.
So when you look at the photographs, generally the walls went out or in, and the roof came straight down and just pancaked anything underneath it. But we slept on the rooftop. It gave us a, you know, if the roof came down, the building came down in one of the aftershocks, which were, you know, constant the whole time we were there on the first trip. I'd rather ride it down 8 feet than have it come down on top of me.
Absolutely.
And it gave you a little bit of a tactical advantage. And, you know, once we climbed up there, it'd be difficult to get up there, at night without whoever was awake hearing you.
Sure.
And then all of our, the Haitians in the village there, that we were staying in and running a clinic out of and everything, they immediately brought everybody down to in front of our building and set up their tarps and camped out in front of us. They had decided that, we were there as missionaries. The comment we heard over and over and over was, you don't look like any missionaries we've ever seen before. Because we approached the trip from a different angle than a regular relief trip just because of the situation. You know, we were wearing armor, we're armed, you know, with lethal and non-lethal weapons. And, that's what, within the orphanage system, they were having a big problem right after the quake of, people would come to the orphanage because they call them, it's a creche, and Haiti is the real word for it. They'd come to the creche knowing that the creche had medical supplies. The creche has food, you know, stored up for the kids.
Yeah.
And what a lot of things are happening, the owners or the people that run the orphanage were being assaulted or even killed, and they just take all the kids' food and, you know, medical supplies and everything and just take off with it. And that was going on nightly, and that's one of the reasons you heard so much gunfire was, if something went bump in the night at that time over there, everybody just threw down with what they had. So, once it got dark, you definitely didn't move around, for, you know, out of concern for the criminal element that was out, as well as, if, you know, you stumble over a piece of rubble and make a little bit too much noise, and, you know, the people on both sides and in front of you are just going to open up on
shoot at you. Because you guys look more like a little military element running around down there than let's say a medical relief team. And you guys kind of had to do everything from the time you got there to the time you left with no real direction by anybody else. You just took self-direction, went where you thought you were needed, and did what you could, right?
Correct. We had our Ruska Village and Bon Repos was where we were staying at. They had a clinic that was built and had some rudimentary supplies to it that we were able to operate out of. And we got word out to, you know, if people were able to get to the village, then we did our best to treat them. And once the field hospital got operational, then if we felt it was secure enough, which we didn't have one time where we needed to get somebody to the hospital, generally a child, that we wouldn't run the gauntlet, so to speak, to go through Port au Prince back to the airport. Once the 82nd got in there and the Marines got in there, then it calmed down. The streets calmed down a lot during the day, but at night, you know, at sundown, then our military secured for the evening, and it was, you know, back to being
same old
again. And then the National Police, you had to really watch the Haitian National Police, because their answer to, you know, they'd get a call or get notified of a riot or looting or something going on. And at that time, really, it wasn't even looting. It was more scavenging, kind of hard to loot a pile of rubble.
Sure.
And, but you'd have people literally thinking, oh, you know, this used to be a grocery store, and they'd be digging through and not even, you know, not fights breaking out. People organize, you know, and just forming like a bucket brigade to move rubble and try to get to, you know, water or food or whatever was in there. It was very much, unlike, you know, Katrina, you didn't have people looting the electronics store.
Yeah, nobody was running away with a plasma TV and saying, I need
exactly.
this supply, right? People were actually
exactly.
looking for anything to fill their stomach for one more day.
Exactly. You know, or, you know, just give that your infant another, you know, sip of water or that you knew that wouldn't kill it from some funky disease that it would develop from it. But, the Haitian police the National Police would respond. They'd pull up, pile out of the back of their Toyota Hilux, and the preferred long gun over there is an M14 with the butt still hacked off at the pistol grip or at the grip, and they just pile out and just, you know, open up on into the crowd. If you're lucky, they'd fire a couple bursts in the air, and after that, they just start zipping 7.62 around you through the crowd.
Oh my God!
And so the best bet was when a big crowd got together. Your best bet was to be outside of that. I
get away from
the middle of it anyway, but because when they show up, it's there's going to be gunfire, and then there's, of course, obviously the conflicts would break out between the citizens, and that.
Yeah, I mean, no matter how benevolent you're trying to be, and whether police or not, you're out there not harming anybody. Somebody starts shooting at you, your natural reaction is, well, you're going to shoot back. You're at a self-defense.
Exactly.
So now you've got all-out war going on. I want to kind of shift gears a little bit forward in time here, because I know a lot of people right now, probably like I was thinking up until we started talking about this, are thinking, well, Haiti, that was last year, and I gave some money to Red Cross and did some relief stuff now, and we did that now. It's taken care of. That's not the case. It doesn't really look much different today than it did when you walked into it in kind of a ground zero mode, does it? I'm sure there's more people trying to help, but the place itself is really still pretty bad.
Yeah, there's a lot more order in the chaos now, but we were last over in May of this year. Our organization, we took a group of 17 nurses and doctors from Phoenix, Arizona, from a church in the Sun Valley Community Church, and we took them over, and it hadn't changed a whole lot. I mean, other than the streets are cleared, there's not bodies everywhere from the quake. Of course, I'm also talking to people on the ground now, and they're back to dig mass graves from the cholera epidemic, but we'll talk about that shortly. But as far as infrastructure, it hadn't changed since we were there in January, as opposed to, you know, our last trip in May. There is still no constant power within the city. It's intermittent. Fuel is stabilized. You can get gas and diesel fairly regularly now. You can also find bottled water within the grocery stores if they have been supplied. But, you know, the average yearly income for your Haitian prior to the quake was like $1,200 a year. And, unemployment, I think, is at 80%. You still have 2 million people living in tents.
Mm.
And
everything that goes along with that, right, as far as disposal
exactly
of sewage and, or lack of disposal of garbage.
You know, and then you have, the tent cities I couldn't imagine, living in them. We were going into some of the early refugee camps in January, and, you know, somebody would come and say, come to the clinic and say, hey, you know, there's a baby here, or baby's mother is sick, we can't bring her here, she's too sick to be moved, or so we would buck up and get out to the wherever their tent city was talk to every tent city in Haiti is run by a pastor, and you'll talk to the pastor, and that's the key to security within the tent cities, is you just can't walk in because you immediately get mobbed by everybody in the city, because they just want help. They want, and that's back in January as well as now. But you find out the kids, but the conditions in January they're living in were deplorable. And now you see it after, almost a year later, and it's unbelievable. Just what you would look at, you know, we would look at it from our standpoint of our standard of living here in the States. You know, a homeless guy in the States would look at it and just turn his stomach.
Wow. Yeah. You'd be like, dude, I got it pretty good. You know, I've got a box. These guys have a rag. You can laugh. We laugh a little bit because I think when we're uncomfortable, we use humor to kind of make ourselves feel better. But it's really an atrocious situation. But let's talk a little bit about the types of injuries you treated. One thing you told me is that when you were down there, it's not like here where a doctor is a doctor. Like, you have a stethoscope on your neck down there, you're a doctor. So you had to treat things at a level that you had never done before, and because there was no one to hand a person off to, it was either what you could do or nothing. And talk first about maybe the major acute type of injuries when you first got there, and then as you've been going back, maybe some of the things that like the diseases, and you said like one of the biggest problems is diarrhea, and you know, anybody can treat that if you know what to do. So kind of help people form their head around what's going on down there, at the same time think about what they can do to be as medically prepared as possible for their own needs.
Well, initially when we were down, the injuries you would see were just what you would expect from the type of event, the mechanism of injury that that caused it. You know, the all crush injuries, 8-16 pound blocks, you know, whole, and a whole wall of it coming down and landing on people, and, you know, legs smashed, you know, legs, extremities smashed completely flat, you know, closed head injuries, open head injuries, just a lot of internal bleeding that there's just nothing we could do for. Like you just said, there's, you know, here in the States, all I got to do when I pick you up in my rescue is I need to stabilize you as best I can with what I got, and I need to get you to tertiary care, to an ER where they have a team of physicians that can need surgery. They can get you to surgery if, you know, whatever you need outside of my scope of practice, or whatever medication you need outside of the, you know, 60 or so I have on my rig, they can take care of. But when we got there, it was a lot different for us as paramedics. It was there was no place to take them. You did what you could, what you got, and you improvised as best you could. And beyond that, you know, you set a prayer with them, and in one of the cases, that's, you know, you look at somebody, and it was just it was a triage situation. You had to look at them and go, no matter what I do with what I got, this patient is going to die.
So I've got to pick somebody that I can actually do something for. And
exactly.
It's a hard call to make, I'm sure.
Decision. Oh, yeah. And especially, you know, you got kids, and you're looking at them going, you know, this would be nothing if there's a trauma center 5 minutes away. This would be nothing if I could get on the phone and call for an ATU, you know, and get a helicopter to come get you. But unfortunately, this is, you know, it's going to kill you, and I have to make that decision, and we have to make that decision to go on to the next person that we can treat. And it's just a mass casualty incident. We all train for it, then fire and police, EMS. But you never think you're going to be in one. And when you are in one in the States, it's just so much different because everybody's there. You know, you're looking at it, even if it was a city event, you know, like 9/11, where you just have thousands and thousands of casualties, where you still can, you have mutual aid, you can get, you know, the circle of care just starts spreading further and further out. But there was nobody, and if you had a question or things that we weren't used to dealing with, because it wasn't just stabilized, get into the hospital, and hospital figures out, okay, well, what's wrong with them other than these injuries, and, you know, what else, what can be done for them? There was none of that getting into the hospital. And now if I have a question, I can pick up the radio and have one of the, you know, the nation's best physicians on the other end of it tell me, you know, okay, well, let's try this, or have you thought about this, or are you seeing this, or, you know, there was no online medical control. There's nobody to call. That's why, you know, when University of Miami, when Children's opened their field hospital back at the airport, yeah, that was a godsend, literally a godsend, because now we had some place we could take people, and they had surgical capability. You know, they had orthopedic surgeons, vascular surgeons, cardiologists, you know, they had everything, they had a hospital. And they immediately opened their doors, and 5 minutes later were completely overwhelmed. You know,
yeah.
Because everybody that was out in the city, all the rescue workers, you know, that was working out there, we all heard about the hospital around the same time. So, you know, everybody's, you know, falls out going there to take their patients in, and immediately overwhelm that facility. But they're still there today. University of Miami is an outstanding facility. They're operating there, and they've been there since shortly after the quake, and they've made a commitment to stay there. And I can't tell you how many thousands of lives, tens of thousands of lives, that hospital saved. I know several that we brought there that wouldn't have made it. And the only thing you can look back at, you sit down at night and you kind of count coup and say, okay, we did this,
and
an after action report. We'd sit on the roof and scarf an MRE and talk about what we did today and what we need to do tomorrow and what we could do different. I always came back to the same thing as, you know, damn, I wish that hospital was here 3 days ago.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now that things have kind of moved forward, right, and people have kind of gotten past the acute, I mean, you had the acute injury, you're either walking around with a limp, no leg, or dead at this point. If it was an acute injury, it's over at this point. But there's still a lot of people sick and dying there. What is the aftermath? Because I've often said a lot of times, if you don't get whacked in the acute event, the aftermath is what you got to look out for, from riots to disease. What is affecting people right now the worst down there? What do they most need to get through it?
Right now, what anybody that's followed Haiti on, who is very rarely, is it in the mainstream news anymore. You know, if you watched even after the quake, you know, it's all you saw for a week or so, and then Brittany colored or changed her hair color or something, and, you know, our media has the attention span of a gnat, so So they shifted gears. But right now, the cholera epidemic that's going on, the last official count that I looked, it was over 2,000 dead, you know, tens of thousands infected, and those are official numbers, so they're not even realistic. Cholera is you know, it's a simple disease just to treat, and you literally poop yourself to death. You know, you get it's a bacterial infection of the gut, and once it takes hold, you know, it can kill you in a day. It can kill a child in hours. It can kill an adult, especially an undernourished, you know, in poor health in general. Person that's living in a refugee camp, it can kill them. People can lose, you know, 18 liters of fluid through their butt. I know that's gross, but that's what it, how it kills you. And it's a simple disease to treat. You know, if you catch it early, all you got to do is just feed them Gatorade, you know, just rehydration salts. And if it's a severe case, you know, a dose of doxycycline or Cipro, you know, antibiotics that we can go to a Publix and get for free ourselves. And you can cure it. You can save a life. And even in severe cases, if they're not dead, if they still got a pulse and any type of palpable blood pressure, then you can resuscitate that individual. You know, spike a bag of saline and pop a limb, and you can save their life. And you're talking about a whopping $3-4 worth of medical supplies to save somebody, and people are dying over there in scores every day. You know, I got pictures that friends have sent me that are over there now that'll make you cry.
Hmm. And it's an easy cure, but if you don't have it, it's not easy.
But if you don't have it, it's not easy. You know, what's killing everybody over there, you know, the acute, you know, the trauma, which, you know, as preppers, I think we tend to focus when we think about medical supplies, we tend to focus on, you know, all right, well, I'm going to be treating gunshot wounds, and I need, you know, trauma dressings and kits, and, you know, if I have that level of IV fluids and large bore casts and this and that and the other, you know, and in reality, you know, that's the first little bit. You know, if trauma-wise, if you're not dead in the first, you know, day or so, you're probably going to be all right. Like I said, you might walk with a limp, but, you know, and if you have the ability to keep that infection from setting in, which killed a lot of people in Haiti, with after effects, you know, we saw guillotine amputations, we saw an amputation that was done with a hacksaw that had been sterilized in vodka.
Wow.
My team we didn't do that, but we saw it, you know, we saw that.
We're getting back to
that was the option.
Yeah, we're getting back to Civil War era medicine
that's what the surgery was at that point. And then if you had the antibiotics, load them up and hope the infection didn't set in. But I mean, as preppers, we tend to think, you know, at least I used to tend to think that way of, you know, a trauma junkie or in trauma, it's going to be bad and I'm going to fix it and, the blood from coming out, you know, and then everything will be better. But what's killing everybody, you know, after the initial disaster, after the initial, you know, wave of deaths, what's killing everybody is your diarrheal diseases. You know, your people are dying of just dirty waters was killing them, you know, immediate dysentery and now cholera and just general illnesses that normally wouldn't be a big deal. And it's just wiping them out wholesale, man. You know, it's medieval. It really is.
I understand what you're saying, too, about the people with the big elaborate kits. I was talking to you yesterday, and I told you about this buddy of mine that bought, like, a field surgical hospital kit for, like, $500. And I said to him, what are you going to do with that? He's not an EMT. He's not a paramedic. He's not. In fact, I didn't tell you this yesterday. This guy failed high school biology. I know because I had a class with him. So I don't know what he thinks he's going to do with it. But there are things that even that guy, and he's a little bit eccentric, could do to deal with these things. So what, I mean, it sounds like one thing you need to have on hand as a way to purify and filter water is being imperative, but what are some other things that we as preppers should focus on outside of, you know, the blowout kit and stuff like that, getting past that trauma and dealing with aftermath?
Like you just said, like I've heard you say countless times, water's life, and if you don't have it, you're a dead man. And that's number one, and I think that should be number one in anybody's aid bag. Is yet another one. That's the top of my head bag. The first thing that you see when you open it up in the first pouch after the airway pouch and everything you can see is a water filter. And, but, cause you're going to need it for a lot of the, anything you're going to treat, you're going to need clean water to treat, whether you're rehydrating somebody or you're trying to make, some sterile IV fluid, whatever you're trying to do, you need it. But things that are, that you don't need, you know, to go to school and be trained for, to use, you know, like IV therapy and things, but, you know, Imodium. Yeah. It's, you know, stupid Imodium. Save your life, save your kid's life, you know, yeah, and then depending on if you have a friendly physician or something like that, just general broad spectrum antibiotics, you know, for whatever little bugs you might pick up or simple cuts that turn into infections, you know, and things like that. Yeah, and that's kind of a gray area where you get into, stockpiling medications, but, you know, Imodium, water purification, sanitation equipment, you know, long-term event, you know, or even not even long-term, a couple weeks, you know, I know I've heard, I think it was, Cody Lundin say, you know, where are you going to put all your poo? What are you going to do with it? You know, have a plan. What are you going to do with if somebody doesn't make it? You know, what are you going to do with if at your location, you've got a body.
Yeah.
It's morbid to think of, but we got to think about these things. You know, sanitation and water purification, those are going to prevent a lot of, the illnesses that clean house in a true long-term disaster.
I can give you one thing people can do for the waste, you know, the human waste, especially in 2 to 4 week period. This'll get you out of a lot of problems. And I picked this up from one of Ron Hood's videos, but it's just basically you have a 5-gallon bucket, a box of trash bags, and a few jugs of chemical toilet stuff, and it's not the cleanest thing in the world, but it'll keep it under wraps, and you can, you know, use it until it's full enough to get rid of it and keep doing that. And that sucks, but it's a lot better than just dropping it in your backyard, and you will get the chemical breakdown of the waste. And I think so people don't generally think of that as a medical thing, but it is, because how much can be caused and damaged by having that, you know, feces out there. It is gross to talk about, but we got to talk about it because it's reality. How much disease can be spread with that?
Well, I mean, and you know how much. Prime example going on right now. Look at Haiti. You know, as cholera is a disease that is transmitted from the oral fecal route. It's by eating or drinking food or water that has been contaminated with an infected individual's fecal matter, and that's how it introduced into the country, and that's a whole political thing that is going on. And my personal opinion, and the opinion of a lot of people on the ground over there, is the reason to keep the UN backyard.
Yeah.
But, you know, and not in any way saying it was an intentional thing, but, you know, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, you know, it must be a duck, and that's where it looks like the disease started. And it was just from, and where did it start from? It started from lack of good sanitation, and that's why it exploded throughout the country, because there is no good sanitation. But as far as an aid bag, you know, obviously the acute stuff, that we were talking about, the trauma for the immediate life-threatening things, in a way that, you know, secure an airway. And I think everybody out there should just take a basic, you know, layperson CPR. Or even, you know, most community colleges will offer a first responder course for $35. You know, it's a one night a week, maybe for a few, you know, 3 hours a night, once a week for a few weeks. And you come out of that with a real good handle on, you know, airway control and, you know, how to stop hemorrhage. You know, you come out of it with the big killers, and you also get a good idea of, you know, just hydration and things that you need long term to keep you in your loved ones alive. Real quick, I just want to plug one of your sponsors. I forgot to mention this, but when our first trip, when we were just talking about water, I remembered it. Jeff, the Berkey guy, he came through for us in a big way on this first trip, and we actually used the sport bottles exclusively for our water purification down there, and we were drinking some funky stuff.
Wow.
Coming through those bottles, and nobody got ill. We didn't. You know,
so they're battle proven now, and they're not real expensive, folks. So those are good item. And I didn't know Jeff did that. I'm going to personally tell him thank you next time I talk to him. He's giving away a system this month, so I'll be talking to him. Yeah, I'm glad you let me know that.
Whoever ends up with it is a blessed individual, because Big Systems, the company has, is a base cap filter, and the bottles we use is an individual level. But and Jeff's a great guy, nobody can go wrong by going through him for their filtration needs. Went as far as to ship stuff overnight air to us before we'd even talked about payment or anything else, just to get it to us so we could it could get here by our jump off time. But anyways, a quick plug for him. He's a great guy and puts out a great product and distributes a great product that I've had a life on more than once.
Let me ask you a question as a medical professional here about dehydration, and I'm not necessarily talking about it from a diarrhea episode, but from it could be. I'm sure you even saw some of it down there where people just don't have enough water to drink, and it's hot as blazes, and they end up dehydrated. I've had that happen to my wife twice because she's a dumb ass sometimes and just doesn't drink enough water, and people will get so nauseated from that they can't you can't get them to drink. And that's like at that point, it's the only thing that'll fix it. Now you, if I'm dehydrated laying out and you've got your kit, you're going to just start pumping fluids into me with an IV. I don't have the training to do that. So other than, get them cool and things like that, is there anything that you can add to your kit to help that person as a lay person?
Once you get to that point where, you've progressed into heat exhaustion into the heat stroke, where you're just so dehydrated that, you're throwing up and you can't keep anything down. If you can't get medical care, you're in danger of dying, and rapidly and in a horrible way. Any type of anti-nausea medication, that you can get, over the counter, and again, for informational purposes, not medical advice, but you can give PR or oral medications. You can give the PR per rectum, and have them affect you the same way. If you can just get somebody to the point where they can take and start intaking fluids, oral fluids. But other than trying to put in some type of antiemetic or anti-nausea medicine.
Is there anything in particular you would recommend that people
keep? That's what I was about to say. I hate to say, but I can't remember. I know Dramamine is a motion sickness medication, but it does have an antiemetic property.
Mm-hmm.
My wife would really be the one to ask, because she's a self-trained herbalist, about the natural herbs or supplements or something that you could take to, ginger or even peppermint or something like that to try to quell the nausea just enough to be able to get some intake, some fluid intake.
Because I've seen people in that state, and once you get them to where they can even put 16 ounces of water into themselves, everything changes. They start to come back to life almost instantly.
Yeah, it's those, dehydration is one of those ah moments in anybody's, whether you're a medical professional or a layperson, and when you see it work and you see dehydration work and you see somebody that you're looking at them going, they don't look good.
Yeah.
And you're scared to, like you said, once you can get them, just get, a few ounces in them and it'll just shut down the body's response that it's having, its negative response it's having, and then they can start intaking fluid. I mean, day difference. It's like anybody that's seen a diabetic, that's hypoglycemic and they get a little bit of sugar in them, and it's, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, they just turn completely around.
Yeah, it's like flipping a switch. Yeah. On training real quick, you are a paramedic, but you started out as an EMT. My understanding of it, and I've never taken any of the courses, so I don't know, but my understanding of the EMT training is it's not that expensive to do, and it's not that there's time commitment, you got to learn a lot of stuff, but it's not that difficult to get through, that it is something that a lot of people could go take the training, afford to do it, and not necessarily be looking for a career and still go that far. Would you see a lot of value to that, or am I properly informed there? Or
Yes, he's exactly right. Tremendous value at it. Depending on your state, different states have requirements, and different schools have different requirements. Some schools require you take the first responder before you can take EMT. And in all honesty, a lot of the things that you learn, 90% of what you learn as EMT, you learn in your first responder course. And then an EMT, it comes into, you're going to come into things that you won't learn in first responders. You're not going to learn any type of assisting with medication delivery. Like, an EMT can help a patient self-administer an EpiPen. When you go through the school, your instructor has the help in quotation marks because it's a prescribed medication. They can assist or help a patient with their asthma inhaler or their Combivent inhaler. They can administer oxygen, high flow oxygen. But the first responder course is the base level, the entry level of any medical training. And it's not, there's no certification or some states recognize or have a first responder test with and certification. The majority of them are start out at EMT basic. But, anybody out there that is interested in doing it, and I would highly recommend it. Like I said, it's not really expensive. It doesn't take a lot of time. And there's no reason you don't have to. Once you go through the class, and you can just say, I'm not looking for a career. I don't care about having an actual license or certification. You just don't take the national test or your state test. But you talk about it, just invaluable information. And less than that, things you learn the difference, first responder and EMT basic course. In EMT basic, you start getting into stuff about, working with a paramedic and assisting a paramedic on an ALS rig. Where you're setting up for IVs, you're setting up for innovation, you're, helping the medic run a code, things like that, depending on the situation and the personnel around you, you may or may not ever need, but just a wealth of knowledge can be gained in any first responder or EMT course, and it's not one of those things where, you learn it and file it away and you never need it. I can almost guarantee anybody throughout their life, if they take one of the classes, sometime in your life, you will use some of that information, whether it's a life-saving event or it's a simple sprained ankle. At some point in time, you'll use it. I think library-wise, I think in everybody's library, there's just a couple books and our survival bookshelves we have. There is the doctor. I can't remember the author right now. I'd have to go look at it. It's a wonderful book. Some of it's written more towards people with basic medical knowledge, but you can pick that book up with no medical knowledge, and it'll help you diagnose specific illnesses and life threats and help you treat them. And it'll teach you and show you ways to get equipment and things that you can substitute for, over-the-counter things that can be used in place of prescription things or different medications. Ditch medicine is a pretty good one. But like we were talking about things that you should have, I think every one of us in our preps and our aid bag, we should have a simple OB kit. That's something you can buy on, any medical supply house. There's nothing in there that's controlled, is under the sale of a physician only, order of a physician only. It's, sterile gloves and drapes and umbilical cord clamps and, all of us, especially all of us men and even us in the EMS field, you hear the words, get the OB kit. And it's difficult to get off the seat because now you're stuck to it.
Yeah.
That's one of the big pucker ones because nobody wants to pull a baby out.
But if you end up in a situation where the kid's coming, he ain't getting away.
Exactly.
And I think there's some creative ways to get some training. My buddy Brian at ITS said he wanted to learn how to do IVs in case you were ever in a situation where I shouldn't do it, but if I don't do it, this person's going to die.
Right.
Heat exhaust, heat stroke is like one of the things you're talking about like that. So what he ended up doing to avoid having to do all of this long, because he didn't want to do this as a profession, but he just wanted the skill set, he took an emergency veterinary medicine, like an emergency, for pets response.
Right.
So, of course, you can learn how to do an IV with a dog, and you don't have to have any kind of special training or certification to be allowed to learn that way. And then the process, as long as you know what you're supposed to be doing, is very similar. So for some people, it's like, we hope we don't ever have to use this stuff. You do it every day. But if we do have to, we want the knowledge. So there are creative ways to get the knowledge. We're getting close to the end here. So I want to talk about, you have set up a nonprofit to help your group get aid to Haiti. You want to tell folks about that and kind of its name and where the name came from? Because I think it's pretty cool what y'all did.
Definitely. Our organization is called Bella Medical Ministries. We're formed, three knuckle dragon paramedics, and we decided that while we were in Haiti, we were talking about it, and we were just like, wow, you know, you're able to help people down here with just the smallest amount of skill set and equipment, and like I was saying, you're talking about $4 worth of stuff, and you're saving babies' lives with it, and something that, like you just said, that you can take a vet class and learn how to do to an extent. But we formed an organization after we came back from the States, or technically our first trip. The namesake, Bella, was the first child that we treated in the village, in Bon Repos, in Ruska Village. We just got in, dumped our gear and everything, and kind of went to the clinic to see what we had to work with, and we're unpacking our equipment and supplies. And one of the girls, American girls that was there, she came in and she said, "We got a little girl that's really sick. Can you take a look at her?" So we're like, "Yeah, sure, you know." And we think, "You know, really sick. Okay, well, let's go look." And the three of us, you know, compiling into the room and looking at her stopped us in our tracks. I've never seen a child so sick. It's so dehydrated. You know, it's words don't even describe. You know, it was way worse than those old late night Sally Struthers feed the children commercial. I mean, she was bad. And the first thing that we thought, I looked at her and my buddy Chris looked at, you know, he dug down and started checking by. And he says, this little girl's going to die. And I said, yeah, and we checked her out, and I said, yeah, I know, and let's see what we can do. And she had, it turned out she had a GI bleed. She also had immediate dysentery. She's sick. And Chris amazingly got an IV into her, because we were planning on doing intraosseous drilling through her, through one of her bones, and fusing saline that way, but then she was just so dehydrated and everything that we figured her bones were so malnourished that her bones would just shatter. But Chris got me into her, and we started feeding her fluids a little bit at the time. She was, at that time, she was so dehydrated, you know, her fontanels and soft spots in her head were sunken in. If we'd have tried to move her, even if we had a good place to take her at that time to a hospital, we couldn't have taken her through the streets. Just the bumpy ride would have just given her, you know, a traumatic brain injury, killed her. And so we got her started going on foods and you know, set up a watch schedule for her, and we kind of pulled back and talked about it and got together and prayed a little bit and said, okay, well, this is the first kid we're going to treat here. Let's all be ready for, you know, sunrise, this little one-year-old girl to be gone. Excuse me. Anyway, so we were ready for her to not make it through the night, and we sat with her through the night and you know, dripping fluids into her, and she got better and better, and her eyes started opening, and we kept her down and on a drip for about 36 hours, because you can't just, that's the other thing about IV fluids, you can't just flood somebody with fluids and consider them fixed, because you will kill them, especially pediatrics, kids. Anyway, she got better to the point where we thought we could move her, and it turns out she was an orphan, and she had been adopted by a family here in the States, but all the paperwork and everything on the American side was taken care of. The Haitian side, all the paperwork in the Ministry of the Interior was gone. You know, the whole building, I got a picture of the building. Not only did it collapse, but then it burned. So there was very little chance of her getting out of the country. And there's no hospital to take her to. Children in UM wasn't set up at the airfield yet. So it was one of those things where if she couldn't get to the States, which was basically impossible for her to be able to get brought back to the United States, if she couldn't get to the States, then she's going to die. And there's nothing we could do for it, because we couldn't stop her diarrhea. We couldn't stop her vomiting. We couldn't stop her her internal bleeding. And we knew it. You know, God moved mountains, and he's in the miracle business. And next thing you know, some papers showed up needing physician authorization for the child to be transferred on a charity visa to back to America for medical care. So, you know, we're at Haiti, we're doctors, so we obliged the U.S. paperwork where the X's were, and and it got back to the embassy, and about 24 hours after that, she was at University of Miami Children's Hospital in Miami, and in the arms of her adoptive mother and father.
Wow. Wow. And that's what's, folks, I want to, one thing I want kind of Brandon to finish up with here is, Brandon, I want people to understand why they should help small organizations like yours. I think sometimes people feel like, well, if I go with like the Salvation Army or something, then I know it's going to help because they're big and they're out. Tell people how much money went to the Red Cross for Haiti and tell people what you've seen out of the American Red Cross in Haiti.
From my understanding, right after the disaster, you could text message, you know, and donate $10. But the number that I've heard over and over is about $2 billion went to the Red Cross directly after the disaster. Other than here and there, you'll see tarps in the tent cities that, you know, were given out by the Red Cross. And my travels throughout Port-au-Prince and other areas of Haiti and a lot of relief workers can say the same thing. I ain't seen one Red Cross representative. As far as I've seen, they are not overly active in Haiti. That $2 billion, that money that was donated to Haiti, well, that money, you know, while when you donated it to Haiti because that was what the acute disaster was, that's not what they collected. They solicited the donations for the Red Cross, so it goes to all kind of other things. The Red Cross is a great organization. You know, they've been around for a long time, but they are a huge organization. They have a lot of overhead. They have administrative costs. They have operations in just about every nation of the world. I look at it like this. If you were to take that same $2 billion, which is about 2,000 million, you were to take 2,000 small organizations, bust Haiti into 2,000 grid squares, give each one of them a grid square of $1 million, and say, make it nice, make it self-sustainable, and make it, you know, so it can be a viable, you know, part of the society, you could turn the country around real fast.
I think you could rebuild the entire island for two. I don't think the GNP of Haiti is $2 billion. I mean, it's insane.
It's the amount of money that's been donated, and a lot of it gets back into the corruption and everything of the, of the government.
Because I know you won't do this for yourself, so I want to do this for you to kind of sway people to do something for your nonprofit here. Folks, $2 billion goes to the American Red Cross, and we get some tarps. These guys put together things literally on a shoestring and go down there and help, and they bring a little girl back to her adopted parents from the verge of death. Now, like I said, I know you won't put it that way because you don't want to hard sell it, and I normally won't either, but in this case I will. So, folks, if you're looking for someone to help out this month, it would mean a lot to me if you could go and just a few bucks, you'd be amazed what these guys could do with it. So, I think we're toward the end there. I just wanted to kind of leave it to you now. What do you want people to take away from this from a standpoint of, one, helping out, two, what it means to them in their own lives, and three, from a preparedness standpoint?
I think one, and I appreciate what you just said, Jack. It's with us, if anybody is wanting to help out, you know, it's a tax-deductible donation, and it's our baby. It's my wife and I and my friends. And of course we have board of directors and accountability, but my personal, word and guarantee is every cent of every dollar goes to, the people of Haiti. It doesn't go to, some other NGO. It doesn't go to finance us, staying in a resort, on the West Coast or anything like that. It doesn't cost a lot to put together a team to go over to help out. Our first trip, our budget for everything that we went over with included buying, you know, food and equipment and everything and airfare, or the small cost it was for us to fly with MFI, was less than $3,000. And trips since then have been less than that. You can make a big difference with a little bit. And from a standpoint of what, you know, for all of us, it was a life-changing experience. And all of us had been in developing nations before. We'd all been in, you know, nations that were under, you know, a constant state of war, whether external or civil. and we've all been in disaster zones, but I've never seen anything so bad. You couldn't do to those people in that city what that earthquake did, you know, with a fleet of B-52s. You just couldn't do it. It's destruction on a scale that is almost unimaginable, and suffering and death on a scale that's almost unimaginable. But like you said, it's almost a year ago, and not a lot's changed, and that's unfortunate. And there's pockets, of course, that has changed tremendously, and there is rebuilding going on. But you go to the areas that things are rebuilt, and they're trying to get back to functioning, and they have clean water, and they have a clinic to go to and bring their families to, and people are starting to, you have businesses that are created, and work that's being distributed, doing something other than just sitting around the tent city all day, wishing you had a job to go to, even if it was, slinging muck somewhere. But the places that things are going to be, that are getting really done, that I've seen, they're small groups that are doing it. They're not international NGOs. And the Lord knows that without the big groups, as much as I don't like it, without the UN help out with security and definitely without our military and over there and our water sanitation people doing what they are able to do, and without groups like University of Miami Field Hospital, then there'd be no hope at all for the country. But this is something, this cholera epidemic, they're saying, some people, epidemiologists saying it's going to run 10 years. Haiti is a long-term commitment to getting these people, it'll take a long time to get them back to the way they were 5 minutes before the quake, which was pretty bad. But, it's the first time you pick up one of these kids and this baby looks at you, just innocent as the day is long, and for $3 you can save them.
That's pretty amazing, really. And I think we don't realize how good we have it sometimes.
Like I said, it changed our point of view, when we were sitting over there, sitting on a rooftop looking out over the city and talking about it, you'll never hear me bitch and moan about things going on in the States to the degree that I know I did prior to that. It'll make you thankful for what you got, and no matter how angry we get at the powers that be, at least we know that our government won't blatantly steal an election from us, at least not blatantly, that when you need help, that you can call the police, and you don't have to be more afraid of them than the people that you called about. We're truly, truly blessed to live.
I've said that before, that we have the military that people go to for help, and we have the police departments that people go to for help. And I think people that haven't traveled to places like this don't understand that in other parts of the world, you don't go to the police for help. You don't go to the military for help. That's the last place you go. And I think some of us don't appreciate what those guys do for us, and just our law enforcement or our military. Yeah. We don't appreciate them enough.
I agree.
You definitely probably do. And for being prior service military, things a little deeper than a lot of, I don't think anybody that's never served will really understand a soldier. I do want to wrap up now because we've got about an hour or 10 here. Folks, I want to tell you guys, I personally vouch for this organization. If you go out and help them, that they're going to do what they say they're going to do. I'm a pretty good judge of horse flesh, as we say here in Texas, and it's an outstanding guy here. And I appreciate you being here with us today, Brandon, and I appreciate the work you've been doing.
Definitely. And the only thing else I want to say, as far as living lifestyle, if you're just getting into it, or if you've been into it your entire life, either way, good on you. As we used to say, but this whole situation over there that happened with that quake is an eye-opening experience, and how in 75 seconds of shaking, your entire world can change. And different situation here in the States, but nonetheless, I don't think a year later we'd still be living in refugee camps, so I hope not, but we all know that there's situations that could cause that, and even if it's not a year, a week's a long time to be hungry. a week without clean water and you're dead.
Dead.
So, especially for the men and women out there with families and kids, you owe it to your family to be ready.
All right. Well, again, thank you for what you've done. Thank you for being here today. And, folks, with that, I will wrap up. This has been Jack Spirico today with Brandon Shelton. Help you figure out how to live that better life. Times get tough, or even if they don't, in this case, how to help some other people live that better life when theirs got really tough.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.